Several of us became aware of our speaker today when we read a article in the Virginia newsletter, Virginia Population Shifts, Localities Face Challenges as Growth Slows. Our speaker today wrote that article when he was still at the university, and our speaker today is Luke Jude. And he is now the director of planning for Waynesboro. He has received his bachelor's degree in political philosophy from Grove City College and master's in urban and environmental planning from the University of Virginia, and was a Fulbright scholar in Botswana. He's originally from Chesapeake, Virginia. And as I said, this article got a lot of attention and it was well written, and so we've invited him to come and speak. And so without further ado, Luke, welcome and thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to be able to speak to you all. Thanks for giving me your time as well, and for being willing to listen and care about all these things. It's incredibly important for local governments that people be aware of what's going on and that people be engaged in the process. And especially, I don't know, not to reference the thing here, especially for seniors as well. I mean, you all tend to vote at a much higher rate and tend to be some of the people that are most involved in local issues. And so I think it's really wonderful that you all are so motivated to understand what's going on in these localities. Kind of as a bit of context for why I think this is important. When I was in planning school, which, as you may have surmised, was not that long ago, we had read an article, you know, that was back from, I believe, the late 1980s or early 1990s, and it was talking about the end of place. And it was basically saying that with the advances in technology, with advances in transportation and telecommuting, that the importance of place as a distinguishing factor would decrease, that over time kind of real estate values would sort of level out, because you could live in West Virginia and you could work in New York City and you could commute from here and there and you could telecommute and do all these different things. And what's actually happened is the exact opposite. Those changes have made place paramount. Because people can be anywhere, they all want to be in the same places now. And so what we've actually seen is that currently real estate values are more polarized than at any time in the history of our country. And place has become more and more important. And it's become thus more important for localities to think about whether they are creating value with their investments, whether they are doing things and using their limited resources to create places that people want to be in or don't want to be in, because that in turn affects their economies. But I also, as another bit of context, and my email is up here in case you wanted to contact me at some point, I am, as I said, the director of planning currently, but all of this work for this paper was done when I was employed by the university at the Weldon Cooper Center. But as an additional bit of context, when I became a planner, when I went to planning school, I obviously learned about planning from playing SimCity as a child. And so my assumption was that that cities are city planning is kind of like this. Where should this go? Where should that go? And I think that assumption is also baked into a lot of people that come out to local meetings. We talk in planning about having the nebulous they. Everybody asks, wants to know why they put the Chick-fil-A there, or why did they put the road over there? And, you know, our question's always, well, who's they? Which they? Because planning is actually not at all like this. It's much more like it's much more like this. You have a lot of things that are not in your control at all. And all you really can do, you're kind of like the captain of a sailboat. And all you can really do is say, where's the wind blowing right now? Is it worth trying to paddle upstream, or is it worth putting out the sail and trying to ride it? And so a lot of what this talk is about is what are the waves that are hitting these local governments. And then from there, they've got to think about, is this a time to fight it or is this a time to ride it? This is population growth in the 20th century in the United States and Virginia. You can see there's a trend. It's going up. That dashed line on the right is the Weldon Cooper Center's population projections for the next 30 years. It looks like we have a very easy job there. There is actually a complicated formula behind that line. But it's based entirely on the history there, on the trajectory. What we've seen is that line fall off a little bit, and I'll talk about that later. But this is a key bit of context because, as you can see, since World War II, Virginia has seen nothing but constant and kind of, you know, relentless population growth. We've seen faster population growth in the country as a whole, faster population growth than many other states around the country. And so our entire perspective for how you plan, how you think about the growth of local governments, how you think about the statewide economy is based on this idea that the population is growing relentlessly. But that's not always going to be true. It's my favorite quotes from Warren Buffett. When the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming naked. So it's not the case that it's not the case that because, you know, we are going to head into a nosedive and you know, Fairfax County is going to be the new American ghetto or anything like that. But it is the case that, you know, when sort of trends like massive population growth that have buoyed everyone up start to recede, you find out who's kind of been making good investments during that time and who's the weakling that's getting picked off near the back of the pack. So that's the thing for localities. That's the implication for localities. Now I'm going to talk kind of about three things during this talk. The first thing I'm going to do, and it's going to be a little bit lengthy, is provide some background on demographics, both so that you can kind of understand how population changes and also what's going on in Virginia right now. Then I'm going to go on to talking about kind of what's happening in different areas of the state and how these trends are affecting different localities in the state. And then lastly, I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of national trends and how cities react to those things. So starting off with a little demographics 101 primer, there are two components of population change. Population change is made up of two different phenomena. One of them, they are natural increase and net migration. Natural increase is a pretty intuitive subject. You know, if you have 100 births in a year and 60 deaths, you have a growth of 40 people from natural increase. So natural increase is the difference between births and deaths. The second way that population changes is through migration. And that's why cities have a net migration factor. And your net migration is the number of people that moved in minus the number of people that moved out. So if 80 people moved here, 90 people moved out, you lost 10 people from net migration. Those two factors together combine to create the total population change. So if you had natural increase of plus 40 and net migration of minus 10, you grew by 30 people. So it's very, a very straightforward concept there. Natural increase and net migration. So we're going to talk about what's going on in both of those components right now. This is a population pyramid, if you can think back to your probably seventh grade social sciences. What you have on the left is a graph of kind of all the males and the number of them with the age there going up the middle, and then females on the right. And it's called a pyramid because historically they were shaped like pyramids. You know, for most of human history, and even if you look at third world countries' population pyramids today, if I were to pull up the population pyramid for Uganda, what you would see is a pyramid shape. And that's because you have lots of births happening, you know, 6 or 7 births per woman happening. And then you have a high death rate at every age. You have high infant mortality, lots of children dying, lots of young people dying all through their life, all up to the very end when it, you know, tapers off at the top. This is the population pyramid for Virginia. This looks a lot like the population pyramid in the United States and in much of the first world now. As you can see, it's becoming more of a population column or kind of an obelisk. And so we'll talk about why that's the case. But that's the fact that it is changing from a pyramid to an obelisk is very important. So another quick background thing to understand when you're talking about natural increase in migration is that the age of the migrants matters. You can't just say, well, this area is gaining 100 people a year and this area is losing 100 people a year from migration. You have to talk about the age of those migrants, and that in turn affects natural increase. Because if you're talking about young people moving, young people do two things that are very important to demographers. The first thing that they do is they have babies. And the second thing that they do is they do not die very often. And so that creates a huge change for your natural increase. So when you look at a city or a state's population pyramid, you look at that bottom bar down there. That's your new births. That number and that size of that, as you might guess, is very, very related to the size of another part of this chart. And it's that chart right there. It's the number of your young people and your young women of, you know, within the high birth rate age cohorts. And so when you're thinking about the age structure in a city, you're not just thinking about whether it's younger and going to get older or older and going to get younger. You're thinking about its effect on natural increase. This is Virginia's population change from 2010 to 2015. For the past, since World War II, our growth has come about half and half, from natural increase, half from net migration, with the net migration being more heavily younger people and feeding into that natural increase. And so we've had this kind of positive snowball of population growth where we're constantly attracting people. Migrants are, I should have explained one more thing about this graph. This graph is a graph of the likelihood or the percentage of people at each age who move every year. And it's unsurprising to you, but, you know, people, pretty much everyone moves at the age of, 18 to 20. It's kind of the massive shakeup. You have children all, scattered around, and then at 18 you shake everybody up. And so for that kind of critical time period, 18 to 34, you have a very high mobility rate. And so during that period, it's crucial that localities attract people of that age group before their likelihood of moving slides down. Otherwise, they're looking at their older age cohorts in 20 years are going to be very small, and their birth rate will be very small. So back to this. As you might have noticed, this is not half and half. We're a little lower on the net migration than the natural increase, and I'll explain that in a minute. All right, so we've kind of talked about the two components of population change. I'm going to talk a little bit more about natural increase and how aging has factored into that. As we hear a lot of talk about how there's an aging population, and what do we mean by that? I mean, people are always aging, right? Every place has people that are aging and also people that are being born. What we mean by that is first that the average life expectancy at birth in the U.S. is going up. You know, if you talk about the 1850s and the Civil War, average life expectancy was 40 years. Even as late as World War II, it was in the 60s was your average life expectancy. Now, this did not mean, it's crucial to understand, this does not mean that, and sometimes you hear people say that back in the 1850s, a 40-year-old man was an old man. That's not true. 40-year-old man was just as old as he is today. They were much less likely to make it to that older age, and that created a lower median age. So if we look at, several presidents that we might know and love here, Thomas Jefferson died at the age of 83. John Adams died at the age of 90. These were old men back in the day, and the average life expectancy in their day was probably below 40 years of age. But that doesn't mean that 40 was an old man. 90 was still an old man. What's happened is not that we are living longer. I kind of say it as like a race. It's not that the race has gotten longer, it's that almost everybody is finishing it now, where it used to be that very few people did. And so this is, you can see at the top of this age, this is the United States age pyramid in 1970. Do I get a laser?
You have to hold them for a few seconds.
Oh yeah. We can see at the top of this age pyramid, kind of the old pyramid structure, right? Lots of births, people dying at every age, and that pyramid is going up. You had a little hiccup here. That's kind of the Great Depression and World War II, and we had population decline there. But then we picked right back up with gusto after that and continued our pyramid shape. But something happens, as you can see, somewhere around that 10-year mark, which would be around early 1960s, that kind of dramatically changes the shape of our population pyramid. Any guesses what that is? There's a confluence of factors. We have growing importance of education in the economy. We have the widespread availability of birth control, and we have also kind of a cultural shift in terms of how many children people expect to have. And so that change creates a new shape, and that bulge becomes what we call the baby boom generation. And then we get a little depression underneath it as the birth rate goes down. So here's 1980. You can see the baby boomers aging up, and you can see that we're not replacing them at the same rate below. As the baby boomers hit the young adult years, we get another little bulge, and that's the millennials. But again, it's not at the same rate that it's been historically. Meanwhile, notice what's also happening. We're not tapering at the top. Massive advances in kind of medical technology, like I said, are allowing more people to finish the race. And so we're not seeing that taper in the population pyramid that we've always seen. Instead, each of these age cohorts is aging all the way through to the top. So here's 2000, 2010, 2015. So the result of that trend is that if we overlay kind of 1980 versus 2015, our population has been growing dramatically, but our birth rate has actually been below replacement rate since the 1970s. And thus, all the population growth is happening in this zone, and that zone continues to go up. So there's actually, if you look at the graph, today in America, there's actually more 60-year-olds than 6-year-olds. The top of that graph is larger than the bottom. And so we're filling out this column where we just have, you know, sort of a average of two children per family replacing onward. And that creates a situation where the growth in population, if you break it down by age group, becomes heavily weighted towards the top. So as you can see in the under 18, the 19 to 34, 35 to 49, basically under 50 age groups, there's been very little change between 2005 and 2015. You get to 50 to 65, and you're talking about a 25% increase in the population, and over 65 population growing by nearly 40%. And so that's going to continue into the near future. How long will that continue? How far up will that graph continue to go? And that's a great question. And you might wonder if we have a way to answer that. We do. We don't know what will happen in the future, what dramatic technological changes or cultural changes will happen, but we can take the current situation and extrapolate it into the future. This is a morbid chart, although I've actually had people tell me that it's very reassuring to them. This is your probability of death in a given year by age. As you can see, it doesn't tick above 1% until you're in your 60s, and then there's kind of a rapid increase there. And so what we can do is we can take that population pyramid and age it through that percentage. So here's our 2015. I've combined both sides of the population pyramid here. And we can age it through that percentage and get a rough idea of, at current life expectancy rates, when we're likely to see, when we're likely to see kind of that whole graph fill out. And it's about 2040 there. So here's our estimated and projected natural increase without migration factored in. And as you can see, around 2040, this is just for Virginia, assuming that nothing else happens, which it obviously will, we get to a point where our natural increase slows down to zero there. And we'll have a brief little period then of natural decrease, and depending on whether birth rates have gone up or down by that point, see whether it, what changes from there. So that's natural increase. Now you understand why the population would be slowing from the growth of natural increase. The second piece of that equation, obviously, is migration. Before I get to that, let me just show that impact for localities. This is 1980. The counties in blue are counties that are experiencing natural increase. They're still having more births than deaths every year. In orange, you have the counties that are experiencing natural decrease, more deaths than births. This is 1980, 1990, 2000, 2005. 2010, 2013. As you can see, as the younger population has become more concentrated in the kind of urban crescent, you also might have noticed the flip. Back in 1980, it was a lot of cities that were experiencing natural decrease, and now it's the more rural counties that are experiencing natural decrease. But you're seeing a big, this is a big impact for a lot of localities. They're used to at least having more babies born every year than deaths, and now suddenly the reverse is true. That gets us to migration, because there's always migration, right? People are always coming to Virginia. And again, since World War II, we have had a constant influx of domestic and international migrants to boost our population every year. That's where we've really seen a dramatic shift in the last few years. And whether it's temporary or whether it's a longer-run problem is something that's yet to be seen. But here's the census estimates for Virginia for the last 5 years or so. See natural increase, holding steady and about to start declining. Net migration falling off dramatically in the last 2 years. And I don't have 2016 on here, but they've gotten estimates out for that recently, and the trend has continued. And here's that net migration broken out with domestic migration. As you can see, it's domestic migration to and from other states in the United States that's become negative. 2014 was the first time since World War II, I believe, or at least since the 1970s, that we experienced, that we had more people leave Virginia to go to other states than come to Virginia from other states. And this is based on census estimates, which are imperfect, but over we've got 3 years of this now telling us that this has happened, and so that becomes more reliable. We have another way of estimating migration, which is IRS tax return data, and they show the same thing. I don't have the most recent 2014 to 2015 up here, but it's roughly the same as this. We have a loss of about 13,000 returns, which corresponds to about probably negative 28,000 people to other states, which roughly lines up with what the census estimates for domestic migration. So their estimates are probably pretty close to accurate. So what do we do with a decline, you know, a projected future decline in natural increase combined with a current decline happening in migration? We put that together and we get a decline in population growth. So this is population growth from 2000 to 2005. The dark green is the fastest growing counties, and then in red are the counties that are declining. Compare that to that first five years of the 2000s to the first 5 years of this decade, and we see a pretty dramatic slowdown across the state. As you can see, places that were growing, still growing. Places that were declining, declining more. But the trend kind of hits everybody across the board. And that's what I mean by when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming naked. So that gets me to how this affects localities. So that's the statewide trend. Let's talk about death and life in the localities. First, I've broken out the components of change by region. So this is a lot of graphs. I hope you liked graphs and charts because you're drinking from the fire hose today. I'll try to tell you which ones aren't important. This one's not as important, but interesting enough. The big thing to take away from this graph is that the bulk of our statewide population growth has come from the Northern Virginia area. And that's probably not news to you. They have had the highest net migration for a long time. And because of their, you know, economically strong and young people tend to follow kind of economic vitality, they've also had the largest natural increase. And so that natural increase in Northern Virginia continues to drive statewide population growth. And thus, it's probably the slowdown in immigration to Northern Virginia and the slowdown in growth in Northern Virginia that's rippling out across the rest of the state. Because the rest of the state ends up being very tied to that that economic engine. And Richmond and Petersburg have started to come back, or Richmond really, as an economic engine. Hampton Roads has kind of floundered in the last two decades. But we're seeing Northern Virginia kind of lead the way. And our smaller metros have become much more popular destinations, but I'll get to that later. Here's just a quick comparison of the births and deaths by region. As you can see, about 40% of the births every year in Virginia happen in Northern Virginia versus about 20% of the deaths, whereas only 10% of our births are happening in our rural counties and 20% of our deaths. And so that's a big factor in where that natural increase and natural decrease is happening. So to try to get a handle on this and try to think of a way to talk about 134 or however many localities in one talk, I've tried to split them into four categories for you to think about based on those two components of population change. So here are my four categories. Kind of, this is all made up. Booming, shedding, attracting, and declining. So booming, I'm saying, is localities that are experiencing natural increase and they're also experiencing in-migration at the same time. Shedding counties are experiencing natural increase without migration, you know, attracting, decrease within migration, and then declining are losing from both, from all fronts, you know. Let's talk first about booming counties. Here are all the booming localities in Virginia. You may notice your current domicile here, Charlottesville and Albemarle County, as well as there's kind of two types of localities that are in this category right now in Virginia. The first is sort of thriving central cities. So we've seen a big comeback for a lot of Virginia's central cities. They're starting to attract a lot of younger migrants. Their natural increase numbers have gone up. We're seeing school enrollment increases in Richmond, Lynchburg, Charlottesville, Harrisonburg, Falls Church, Arlington. So a lot of Virginia's central cities are doing much better than they did before. The other kind of locality that's still booming is kind of suburban counties outside of booming metro areas that still have a lot of room to grow. And the key thing to understand with booming counties is that they are both growing naturally, and yet despite that growth, they're still able to attract migrants. So there's clearly room to grow. They're still finding room for new people. So we have booming suburbs and also central cities. The second kind of locality is the shedding locality. And those are mostly well, really nationwide, I would expect them to be more stable central cities. But also central cities that aren't as attractive, aren't being as successful at their comebacks, and then it's kind of built out suburbs. We only have a few of these counties, but there's some, there are our largest jurisdictions, Fairfax County, Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Hampton, Newport News. Attracting counties is mostly counties along the Chesapeake Bay, the Blue Ridge, kind of the Cumberland Valley, a lot of really beautiful rural areas that are very accessible to a metro area. And I'll talk about why that's important later as well. And then the declining counties that we have that are losing on all fronts, a lot of south side, southwest Virginia, and then kind of some scattered rural counties up around the Blue Ridge as well. So back to the booming counties here. We have kind of revitalized central cities. They're in metro areas with strong economies. They have great urban amenities. Colleges, hospitals, technology are driving a lot of that growth. That's true here in Charlottesville. A key common factor in all booming localities is they are attracting educated young adults. They've been successful at getting that demographic to move to their area. We also have expanding suburbs, mostly in metro areas that have strong economies. They have room to grow, so they're still growing through greenfield suburban growth. And they're attracting families from the central city that they're tied to, as well as other age groups. Here's an example of an age pyramid for a central city. This is Richmond. Richmond has a university, and that's reflected in kind of their boom starts around age 18. But they're like most central cities in that they have a large cohort of young adults, and that in turn influences at the bottom, you can see this kind of rocket ship's shape here, their birth rate. This is a net migration by age graph. So this is the rough net gain in each of these age groups compared to 10 years earlier. So this is calculated by saying, okay, there's this many 18-year-olds here this year. How many 8-year-olds were there 10 years ago? When did they come in? And so as you can see in Richmond, you have a big boom starting at age 18 because they have a university, and they're gaining young adults. Then they kind of lose people in that middle age as they start to have families. Same thing's true for Arlington. Arlington starts at 22 since they don't have a university. Same rocket ship shape, though. And same graph, though, again, starts at 22. Gaining young adults and then kind of slowly losing some families at older age groups. The second kind, as I said, are booming suburbs. These are suburbs that still have room to grow, still have green ability to have greenfield development. This is where I grew up, Chesapeake, Virginia. Most suburbs have this kind of graph, so they're losing all their young adults at age 18, not all of them, you know, but a huge proportion of them, and then they're gaining back families, and then they're losing people again around retirement age. So that's kind of a suburban typical suburban locality. And they create this kind of two-pronged graph then, age pyramid, where they have, you can see growing numbers of children and middle-aged adults, and then a big gap in that middle section. So those are the booming localities. Everybody with me still? Let's go on to the shedding localities. Oh, sorry. Well, one last note on that. A big factor that I think is very important in this is understanding the kind of society that we've created. I really think, I always note just that I think it's just odd from a like global historical perspective that we might be one of the first societies we've created where at age 18, you know, like all of our most competent young people are uprooted and sent somewhere else. And so that creates this massive shakeup where, you know, then they're sent off and acculturated somewhere else and connected to different networks. And so then it's not assumed, you can't just assume that, well, our locality has this many people and people will born and grow up and die here. You know, you will lose all of them at a certain age, and then you will have to get them back or not. and that creates a big boom of young people in these central cities. So nearly a quarter of Arlington's residents are 25 to 34-year-old college graduates. Arlington and Alexandria combined have a little less than 5% of the state's population, but they have over 16% of the state's 25 to 34-year-old college graduates. Northern Virginia has about a quarter of Virginia's population, but over half of its college-educated 25 to 44-year-olds. So that demographic is what's really shifting things. It's that kind of college-educated young people who are moving towards where they can find economic opportunity and who are geographically mobile. So that brings us to shedding localities. This one, I think, is one of the most interesting things to try to understand. You're growing from natural increase, so you have more births than deaths, so you've got to have at least a somewhat young population. but then you're overall losing migrants. More people are leaving than are coming in. The reason for this is often that you have a high birth rate because you're attracting young adults. So shedding localities are generally attracting young adults because they are, you know, a more central city. They probably have more affordable housing. They probably have more economic opportunity. But they're either not attractive enough to really keep those people and boom, or they are kind of so dense that there's a strong pressure to pushing out. And this is why cities are always losing people but keep growing. This is one of my fun pet peeves, because every year the census estimates come out, and one city in the country leads the nation in out-migration. It's actually not. You'd think. It's New York City. New York City loses more people every year than any other city in the country. So there's always a raft of articles about how New York City is dying after that. And that's not true at all. New York City is gaining 60,000 people a year, despite its kind of astronomical rents. They've grown by 300,000 people in the last 5 years or so. So how are they continuing to boom despite having the highest out-migration? And the answer is this phenomenon of, that's why I said it matters what age your migrants are. because a central city is generally attracting young adults. And so they're moving in, chasing that economic opportunity, and so your migration numbers from them are +2. And then, you know, while they're in the city, they do what young people do, and they have babies. And then, you know, and then the cost of living, and, you know, you need some more space, and you get pushed out. And so then your out-migration is -4. And so that's why central cities tend to have high natural increase from their younger populations, but then high net out-migration as those people get older. Kind of think of them as fountains of people that are pushing themselves out. That wasn't true in the 70s and 80s, though. That's what's an interesting thing about it. So we only have a couple of localities that match this description. One of them is Fairfax County. And they have this kind of graph where they have they attract a decent number of young people after college. Obviously, they lose again all their college students. And then they have a lot of families, retain a lot of families, but then kind of push people out as they get higher up. And Fairfax County is kind of a classic. It's our New York City in a way. It's a place where young people are coming because it's near that economic vitality of D.C. But then it's built out in the way its zoning codes and everything are structured to the point where the housing is very expensive and there's not a lot of opportunity to grow a lot more. So as the population grows from natural increase, prices go up and people leave the top. So they get this kind of graph, where they're attracting young adults, kind of attracting families, and then losing people as they get older. Another example is Virginia Beach. Norfolk also has this issue as well, Portsmouth, Petersburg. The other thing is it can be a central city, so it's more likely to be gaining young in-migrants, but then it's not actually that attractive. And so it's people who are moving in for cheaper housing and because they're starting out, and then kind of as they get older and make money and have a choice, they go somewhere else. Same kind of deal with Virginia Beach. Again, you can see a lot more people leaving than coming in. But because the people coming in are younger, the population stays afloat. So. All right, so that brings me to attracting counties. This is now the most common, not by population, but by number of localities, the most common phenomenon in Virginia. And these are localities that are experiencing natural decrease. They have more deaths than births, but they are experiencing in-migration to make up for some of that. These attracting localities are kind of the opposite of the shedding ones. They tend to be places that older people are migrating. This is a map of kind of where the first cohort of baby boomers are likely to move. And if this is all confusing, you don't know which parts of the state are which, don't worry about it. But the big point is that there's a lot of talk about how older people, at least a few years ago, there was all this talk at planning conferences and stuff about how retirees were all going to move into the cities and need condos and stuff like that. And that's certainly happened to a certain extent. It's a very visible cohort for whom that's true. On net, though, we're finding that that's not true at all. Most older people, when they move if they're moving in their 50s or 60s, are moving out further, moving to more rural areas, and often getting an even larger house, which is kind of perplexing. But I don't think it's that perplexing at all, because I think if you really look at it across the country, most people don't buy as much house as they need, quote unquote. Most people buy as much house as they can afford. And when you're in your 50s and 60s, you're at the peak of your earning potential. And I also hear anecdotally all these people say, like, well, I want my kids to be able to come home. And so lots of, I don't know, survey whether that's true or not. So what we're seeing is a lot of older people, as they retire, who do move, tend to move out of central cities and suburbs and move towards kind of beautiful rural areas. They're not, you know, they don't have to commute to their job anymore. They still want to be pretty close to the metro area, close to the kids. So they're not going to like the middle of nowhere, but they're going to kind of those Orange County, Culpeper County, you know, the Blue Ridge, Eastern Shore is a huge destination for retirees. And that creates an interesting phenomenon in those counties. This is Nelson County. Any residents of Nelson County here today? You can see kind of a typical pattern here for a rural county. They're losing all their 18-year-olds and all their college students going off. They're gaining back some families, not a ton, and they're having a big increase in these older age groups here. And so that really changes the calculus for those counties, because you get into a little bit of a spiral situation where your population is aging. In fact, I think I have. This is Nelson County's age pyramid. Compare that to 1990. So all your growth is up here. And as a result, you're experiencing very few births down at the bottom. And so your natural increase is really taking a dive. Which is fine as long as you're continuing to get enough in-migration of older people to make up for that. But it does snowball a little bit. And indeed, we are now seeing Nelson County start to lose population. Lancaster County, another great example out on the Eastern Shore. You know, again, you can see they're losing all their 18-year-olds here, getting back some families, but then mostly have this huge influx of people in their 60s and 70s. And so that, again, creates a very, this is an age graph. Sorry, I'm pulling these from different presentations, so they're in different formats, but you know, that age pyramid getting very top-heavy in those localities. For some localities, this is a strategy. This is a deliberate, I mean, Bath County has been doing this for years, and they deliberately do it. I mean, it's kind of a retiree tax haven, because you end up with no kids, so you barely have to fund a school system, and that's half of your local tax rate. And so that, you know, it's not necessarily a losing strategy, but it is something that creates, it does not create long-term population growth. You know, often those counties get into that spiral as their births go down and down and down. It also gets very hard to attract any kind of economic development project because those people are looking at workforce, and so you're hollowing out your workforce in the middle. And so, you know, some localities have just said, yeah, go for it. You know, we're a retirement haven, and that's what we do. Others are really trying to fight that still and trying to get a, you know, manufacturing plant or something in, and those companies are looking at it and saying, well, you don't have the workforce anymore. All your young people are leaving and not coming back. So then lastly, we have declining counties. These are counties that are further away from the dynamic metro areas, so they're too far away to be great attracting counties, or for whatever reason they're just losing population. You mentioned Henry County, Martinsburg is down there in the bottom. Dickinson is our example here. As you can see, a lot of these declining counties have kind of the same pattern as the attracting counties. They're losing all those young people, maybe getting a few families, and then getting some older in-migrants, but they're not getting enough in-migration to make up for the natural decrease. And some of those attracting counties are on their way to becoming declining counties. That's kind of the last stop before you hit that. So this results in, obviously, population decline. And so your numbers of people go down. So that's kind of a quick comment on what population decline does for a city. It doesn't have to be a bad thing, you know, if you plan for it, if you want that. But it can be, because a lot of cities' mindsets and the way that they plan is built around endless population growth. And population growth does do something for you as a locality. It makes planning a little bit easier, because you can kind of always rely on, there's always going to be something going on. There's always going to be some new area that's changing, always going to be some new construction to rely on, and always some demand for all of your housing stock. And so it's much easier to stay afloat. When the tide goes out, again, you find out who's been swimming naked, you suddenly have a situation where there's no demand for new construction, and then the numbers of people to occupy your existing housing stock are declining. And so your infrastructure was built out for a certain number of people. You know, kind of like if I'm going to get a house with like five roommates, and we calculate that it'll cost each of us $500 if we split this house, and then like two of them bail. Now the other three of us are stuck paying the whole, you know, splitting it three ways now. And so that's kind of the situation that some counties find themselves in as they get into this cycle. So those are the waves that are hitting us. So we're going to talk about a few of the other big waves, national trends. This is partly just an excuse to talk about a paper that I wrote while I was at the Cooper Center, but I think you'll find it somewhat interesting. First, we'll talk about what's happening in metro areas, and this kind of affects some of those localities. In most metro areas, what you're seeing is a massive shift. The paper there was called The Changing Shape of American Cities, and there's a big chart tool. You can look at every city in the country and see this. Charlotte is the example that I'm using here. In 1990, and this is kind of the pattern that existed from World War II up to the 1990s, we had what we'd call the old donut shape in the U.S. of cities. And you're all probably familiar with the old donut because you grew up with it. The center of the city is poor, disinvested, minority-dominated. There's a ring of wealthy white suburbs around, and then you kind of have the rural areas beyond that. So that's the donut shape. You can see the donut shape here in this graph. The bottom axis is miles from the city center. So the zero mark is like the center of downtown Charlotte. And then this is a graph of the per capita income in Charlotte in 1990. So at the very center of the city, that zero mark, you have the lowest per capita income in the region. And then you have that hump about 8 miles out, and that's your suburban ring. And then beyond that, it falls off to kind of rural levels. So that's your donut. What we're seeing over about 20 years, that totally changed. And what we're seeing now is this new donut shape, where now the center of the city is the wealthiest part. And, you know, we've had this massive revitalization of central cities and downtowns across the country. And in most cities now, the dead center is where you will find the highest rates of education and income. Then in the middle, you have this inner ring, calling it inner ring suburbs. Usually older suburbs, that first ring of them, sometimes older urban areas, that outer ring of them, that are aging now. Maybe they were, you know, new suburban houses in the 1960s that were 1,000 square feet each. And now those are tiny homes on their, you know, that are aging and nearing the end of their productive lives and that haven't been renovated yet, maybe. And so that's your inner ring. So that's where incomes are falling. And then further out, you have this continued suburban boom. So you have an outer ring of suburbs that are continuing to expand and are brand new construction. So this is an important trend to understand, especially when you read stuff about, like, everybody's moving back to the city. You know, everybody, all the cities are coming back. That's kind of true. Central cities are absolutely coming back everywhere. It's also true that suburbs are still alive and well out in that outer ring. And then a lot of the poverty now is migrating to that inner ring. You can see this in the graph of educational attainment. This is the percent of people that have a four-year degree in Charlotte. Obviously, more people have four-year degrees now than did before, but you can still kind of see the same trend. The center of the city used to be the lowest, now it's the highest. You have that inner ring, the little slump there, and then you have an outer ring. That's where people continue to expand out. You can also see this in the poverty graph. You have the center of the city used to have super high poverty rate. It was lowest at the peak of that suburban ring, and then it kind of flattened out at these rural levels here. And nowadays, you have kind of all the poverty graphs moving 5 miles out, where the center of the city still has a lot of poverty. It hasn't, like, we haven't seen like a mass, you know, decline in poverty. But if you're 5 miles from the center of Charlotte, you're looking at a shift from 8% poverty rate to a 22% poverty rate. That's a dramatic change for those neighborhoods. And then we're also seeing a huge shift in the age gravitation. This is the percent of people who are aged 22 to 24. It's always been true that younger people are more likely to be in denser urban areas, but it's become dramatically more true today. Today, if you look at any city in the country, including ones that don't have a distinguishable new donut, you'll see this kind of graph where the highest concentrations of young adults are in the center of the city. They're also the most educated young adults. And then you kind of fall off. And further out, in that outer ring of new suburbs, is dominated by wealthier older families and older buyers, and you see very few young people buying out in those outer ring suburbs. All right, and then, so kind of the three parts of the new donut, and we can see them right here in Charlottesville, so I've pulled us some pictures from around here and other cities. The urban core is those older, historic, kind of dense urban areas. They're seeing revitalization. They're now attracting some of the wealthiest people who want to live and work, and especially attracting young people. It's our downtown mall in Charlottesville. Then we have the inner ring, and these are older suburbs, often kind of have aging strip malls, infrastructure on its second life cycle, which is crucial. You know, the first life cycle of infrastructure is built by the developer to make his homes valuable. After that, it's up to the city, and so as those roads kind of reach the end of their usable lives, you have lower property values supporting that. a lot of those counties struggling. This picture on the bottom right is actually from Ferguson, Missouri, which has got a classic inner ring suburb, built as an all-white suburb of St. Louis for people fleeing the city. Now it's, you know, it's where that poverty is more likely to gravitate, and you can kind of see it's a lot of times it's like small single-family homes that were new suburban homes 50 years ago, and now those are smaller. This is around Hydraulic Road in Charlottesville, and kind of our inner ring stretches from kind of around Barracks up to Hydraulic, up to Rio, in that range, and then down near Kale, just south of 64. But Charlottesville is doing well enough and has a stringent enough growth restrictions that there's demand everywhere. So we don't have a really depressed inner ring, and that's kind of true in most places. Hey, don't think about the inner ring as like the new ghetto. It's a lot of times what you're seeing is just kind of decline and stagnation. It's not the same kind of concentrated poverty that we had with the old donut. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but and then the outer ring, you can see Crozet up here in Forest Lakes. The outer ring is your newest suburbs on the fringe that are continuing to expand. And they're usually much larger homes, much newer powerhouse retail centers, new construction. So that's what's going on in metropolitan areas. And then around those metropolitan areas, what we're seeing, and this is related to the collapse of the rural economy. We've seen a massive kind of rural economic collapse, especially in the 90s, that sucked a lot of nearby rural counties into the metro area's orbit. So what you see now is that any county within an hour and a half of D.C. is functionally serving the D.C. metro area. All of its income is being derived from that, whether through commuting, becoming kind of a tourism center or, hosting a lot of those retirees that are moving out to that area to kind of be near the metro area but in a more beautiful setting. And then beyond that, those satellite counties that haven't been able to latch onto a metro area, we have kind of real rural areas and real rural decline. And that's where there's been all kinds of stories this past election cycle about the decline of rural America and places that are not near one of those metro areas. So that's what's going on. Those are the waves that are hitting these localities. I talk a little bit in the paper, but we can talk more in the question and answer period about how localities approach that, whether they fight the wave or ride the wave or put out the sails or take them in. For booming localities, a lot of them are struggling with this rapid growth. To what extent do they use that growth to do really high quality development, but then also there's a lot of demand and their prices are skyrocketing, and so they need to allow rapid growth of their don't want the prices to skyrocket. And then you have on the other end of the spectrum declining counties, and what do they do in these, especially in these rural areas? And the answer for declining counties, they have a number of options. One of them is you can kind of double down on the rural economy, try to build up farm succession programs, and try to attract kind of rural manufacturing stuff. A lot of that stuff is tougher to get now, too, because a lot of, like I said, you have the workforce issue. And a lot of larger manufacturers like to be located near but not directly in a metro area. So you can double down on your rural economy. And some localities have done this effectively. Louisa County is one. Rockingham County is another. Still some of the largest agricultural producers in the state. Another option you have is try to string yourself a metro area together. A lot of the Southwest Virginia coal towns have started to cooperate, between Norton, Coburn, Wise, Big Stone Gap, Tazewell, a lot of those towns are now realizing we're all located within a half an hour of each other. We're not viable as small towns. We need to think as an economic region. They have coordinated economic development partnerships and economic development programs to try to sell them as a metro region. Another possibility is you can kind of hitch your cart to your nearest metro area. Floyd County's done this very successfully. They're actually seeing an increase in population now and after a decrease as their rural economy declined. And it's because people from the Blacksburg metro area, which is booming, are commuting in from Blacksburg or coming out to Floyd to recreate. And so Floyd is rather than trying to double down on their own agricultural economy, they have gone instead after figuring out ways to lure dollars out of their nearest metro area. Kind of Smith Mountain Lake is another example of that. Attract those tourists and people that want to go out and live in that kind of beautiful setting. So those are the ways they're hitting us and what we got to decide to do with them. And there are all kinds of decisions that localities face every day about what to do. If you want economic independence, get yourself a chicken plant. If you want to be revitalized, maybe don't and try to attract nicer things that will get, will draw metro area folks out.
Fantastic. Let me open it up for a Q&A. Because the session is podcast, wait for the microphone. We have a microphone on both sides. And so let's just open it up.
Thank you. Went a little long there. Sorry for
no, that. Perfect.
I just wanted to make a comment. Your graphs about the change from 90 to 210 in terms of location to center city, it really resonates what's happening in Outworld.
Yeah,
so, so, for instance, Greer has 80% free and reduced lunch.
Mm-hmm,
so that's exactly that trend that you were showing of right. older suburbs.
Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of older suburbs that were built for a wealthier set of buyers, and so they're kind of their pro formas of their financial model is built on that. You have stretched infrastructure, but you can pay for that if you have high value homes. And then now you're getting a lot of poverty moving into those areas. I think Albemarle County's poverty rate's up to 10% now from about 6 in 90.
Our free and reduced lunch has gone from about 18% to 29%.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. And that's part of the reason the county's facing tough financial problems right now.
So we've got a question here, a question back there. So let's go back here and then up here, John, for the second question.
Yes, sir.
Does the basic organization, by that I mean cities and counties in Virginia, being the only one in the nation that's not incorporating right. those two, does that present inherent barriers to having the planning and the coordination to accomplish some of the goals you're talking about?
I'm not sure. I kind of want to say it does, and then I can't really think of an example why it does. There is an element of even looking at Charlottesville, Albemarle, you have the city being independent in the middle. And so during the old donut phase, you have the city struggling in the middle and not being able to access kind of that higher tax base out there. Now we might have the opposite thing start to happen. Maybe they should be more coordinated and consolidated, but I don't know. There are states that function differently, and there's always a big debate about does it work better, and I don't know. Yeah, I can think of reasons why it would, but I can't point to data that says it does. So.
Good questions. Is this on?
Yeah, just
okay.
Point this way.
All right. One, I noticed you had a slide of Floyd, and I think Floyd has done one of the things mm-hmm. that works, which is to find a niche mm-hmm. where you have the whole country western thing or mm-hmm. whatever they're calling it these days, that seems to have brought a lot of attention and money into
yeah.
Floyd. Do you see that in any other places in Virginia?
Absolutely. We're in the middle of our comprehensive plan process in Waynesboro right now, and a big thing that we talk about is what do we have to offer, and a big thing for us is outdoor recreation and targeting that. And I think what you're seeing is the more that people become geographically mobile, the more that cities function more like corporations and less like governments, because they become less monopolistic. And so I think it's really important. A lot of times people's views of local government are formed around their views of the federal government, and they're not the same thing. Your city is not the federal government making rules. Historically, it might have been. People were going to live here for this reason, and then you just kind of had some rules on top of that and services that people voted to provide or not provide. That's not true at all now. Your cities are competing with each other actively, and they have to find niches and new ways to deliver value and ways to make their numbers work and things like that. Yeah.
Second question has to do with interconnectivity. It seems to me that the places that are going to grow are those that have high-speed internet available, and I think Charlottesville areas understood that. What other areas in the state have done that?
A lot of the state is focused on getting really good high-speed internet. I would think that that's going to become more of a baseline thing and less of a competitive advantage. It's more like if you don't have high-speed internet, just don't try. But I don't know that one metro area is going to beat out another metro area by having slightly faster internet. But yeah, I think that's probably important. And we're at the point where most of the areas of the state, Southwest and Virginia, put in a bunch of money into trying to to bring that out. And some, that's why some localities and some cities across the country have actually said, this is a public utility, we need this to be competitive, and so they've invested in public systems, and Danville actually has one like that. The Virginia State Legislature has now banned cities from doing that. So, yeah.
I've got a question over here.
Yes, Dave. Okay.
Thanks, Luke. Given, I'd say, four trends you appear to have identified here, hot-cold economies scattered around states and the nation, these kind of new demographic trends related to migration, housing affordability crises that are emerging, and then the last one, the kind of corporatization of municipalities. Mm-hmm. Okay. Doesn't that suggest a new role for states? To smooth out the wrinkles here, you're focusing mostly on what cities or municipalities can do, but maybe a la the state of Hawaii, where they pick up the tab for most of the educational expenses, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have huge inequalities when the locality pays for the education off of it, because your poorest localities have the least money to spend on education to, you know, then create the poorest kids. So yeah, a lot of states have said education funding should not be based on local property taxes; it should be an income tax thing. And that also eliminates a lot of the nastiest local feuds. I mean, a lot of the just the worst things. I mean, you think people aren't racist until you talk about school stuff. Like, it just you eliminate a lot of that if the state does the education funding rather than the locality. Another issue is the housing affordability. California is now starting to enact a lot of California localities are very anti-growth, so they do not allow new home construction. And so that's created a huge housing affordability crisis in California. Everybody hears about San Francisco. And that arguably weakens the state and makes it difficult for them to retain young people. More young people leave California now, whereas the young people used to go out there. But on the locality level, the incentive is actually for them to keep doing that. Because like I said, I mean, they're as a locality, it makes sense for them. If you can control the supply of housing and you have can maintain your high demand, then you push out all of your low lowest level, all your poorest people who are also your highest service demanders. And, you know, it's a pretty positive model. So that's something where the state needs to look at that and say, okay, the incentives for localities are messed up here. Maybe we need to change the laws. And so California is now setting up some, and New Jersey already had some before, laws about how much a locality really can restrict housing construction and how much affordable housing they have to deliver. And they setting targets for each locality based on their current density. So, yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of stuff become, you know, states are going to have to come in and arbitrate as cities compete. Yeah.
Hi. You mentioned, I think, accurately that a great many people seem to think of growth as being a good thing or a simplifying thing. On the other hand, biologists will argue, based on various sorts of indications, that we already have far more people in the world than the planet can sustain long term. And
I'd probably argue with that.
Sorry?
I'd argue with that, but okay.
Well,
so you know,
biologists will argue with that pretty strongly. And in that sense, I think it's actually good news that we have some population declines in Virginia, and what we ought to be doing is in fact trying to learn how to manage declining population, because this is something that's in the future of the human race, I think a lot of people would say. The other thing, to turning to Albemarle, which I think a great many or most of us here live in, or Charlottesville, I mean, I think population growth that's gone on in the last 30 years or so, I think a great many residents would say it's actually produced fiscal stresses, environmental losses and stresses, and in declines in the quality of life. And the county, I know, is taking some steps to try to minimize that, things like permanent easement programs for open spaces. And then, for example, as I understand from people who are doing the economic development here, it's focused much more on local, our support for local businesses, rather than bringing in outside companies that tend to attract a great many young people and promote yet more growth.
Yeah, I think you point out correctly that you do have to be I do think that growth can be good for localities, but I think it also, you have to be wary of it. And like you said, some of this is just national trends. You can't do anything about it. Population's going down. You have to plan for decline. And a lot of cities, we could look to places in the Rust Belt that have been dealing with this for decades now. Youngstown put out a comprehensive plan in the early 2000s, and it was really kind of groundbreaking because it's been very politically unpopular in most places to admit that you're going to decline. Every plan is about how we're going to start growing. And Youngstown's plan started with the premise that they would shrink by a certain number of people, because that was what was happening. And so their plan was a plan for decline. How do we consolidate our infrastructure? How do we try to make it more fiscally sustainable given a lower population? I don't know that we need to do that yet. We might need to do that in some places in Virginia. I think you also bring up a good point that economic cycles do come and go. You have the auto boom in building Detroit, and then that declining, and you can't depend on one thing forever. My locality, Waynesboro, had DuPont, and spandex was invented there and everything, and so that just was always going to be there, and one day it wasn't. And then now we have a massive retail center that we're milking, and then people assume, well, that's just going to be there forever. Walmart always is coming in, and that's not going to be there forever. So when you do have a boom time, I think it's important to take the proceeds of that, and you can see, I could give you examples of cities that have taken the proceeds of their boom time and invested it in long-term things that will create social capital and capital locally that will sustain them in the bad times. And a lot of times the assumption of places that are experiencing the boom is that all they're doing is fighting the boom or riding the boom and not thinking about the time when it's not going to be there. Higher education could be a bubble, some people say. Maybe Charlottesville will be struggling in 30 years. Who knows? What investments are we making now with our proceeds of this boom to be sustainable in that time? So.
Hampton Roads, is that the out-migration declining of the military in Hampton Roads, or are there other reasons?
I'm from there. Definitely GIFCOM was a big blow, and that left. I think probably the lack of growth in that. I think what you also see is that when you have a major major institutional or governmental investment that creates a lot of growth, that can build on itself later, like Stanford and that kind of Silicon Valley growth was arguably started by a big federal investment in defense research there that drew a lot of PhDs there. And then in turn, you have kind of spillover effects where they are creating other labs and starting other things. And you don't really see that around military bases a lot of times. Military base is a sure way to get a lot of immediate growth, but then you don't create a lot of times longer-term spillover effects. That might be what's happening in Hampton Roads. It might also be that they made a lot of really bad decisions over the course of the last 40 years. After I moved out. Well, no. I was a child. No. That's Hampton Roads where we want to talk about how city divisions hurt you. Yeah.
So we've got a question over here. I'll come back.
Yes.
First of all, thank you for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
I heard of an abbreviated version of this last fall, and I was really glad you were coming because I knew you could outdo yourself.
Appreciate it.
Oh. Charlottesville is at a loss to have you go to Waynesboro, but that's
Stop. All right.
To piggyback on the thing about the internet, et cetera, mm-hmm. is we have had. As you say, we have a lot of people moving here who are retirees, and retirees are interested in medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of the medical care people say they can now do it in your home using the internet and et cetera. Do you think that would have any effect on spreading people out because they don't have to come in quite so close?
Yes. I think... And that's the thing. So my graphs aren't real good as you get up into the upper age brackets, but I talked about how like a lot of older people moving to those kind of nearby rural areas and wanting to move out to smaller towns and rural spots. There seems to be a little bit of a rebound as they get closer to like 80s, and that might be that it's tough to live out in the middle of nowhere as you get older. And so I think perhaps advances that allow people to live in those places longer might incentivize more than to do that. I don't know. It is a little bit of a conundrum that we're starting to hit. As I'm looking at these trends thinking, what are all these older people are moving to rural areas? What are we going to do in 20 years, or what are they going to be doing? I'm not sure. That's probably going to be important for those localities to think about. Yeah. Good point, no answer.
I just had a quick comment about Hampton Roads. I think I read the other day that some governmental entity said, we're not going to build transit here. If these young people want to have transit, they should go somewhere else.
As the city of Virginia Beach.
In essence, they said, get out of here. We don't want you. It was odd.
Yeah. Hampton Roads has some funny political things going on that I could talk about for a while. Tidewater Home Builders Association is very dominated local politics there for a long time. And it's tough to refurbish some of those areas. Virginia Beach always just grew through kind of greenfield suburban development, and now and that was always reliable and a boom, and then now they've hit their green line and they can't expand anymore, and so now they're having to go back in. If they want to grow, they have to densify, but they didn't really build any of their infrastructure for that. They kind of, it's all suburban. So and then Northern Virginia is a perfect example of one thing that I'm big on is admit how much you're going to grow and then build for it. Because I think what happened in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads is you build this kind of suburban infrastructure and you say, well, we're going to be, do this kind of growth. And then later you grow a bunch more and it's not, the roads aren't really laid out for that. And it's another soapbox.
This is rather small. Well, it has to do with small places. New England, mm-hmm. I have friends who live in Maine.
Yes.
And during the winter, there is not all this influx of tourists, but you have all the people who are supporting the the tourist attractions there, mm-hmm. and they have to depend a lot of it based on charity. Mm-hmm. And I think this sort of thing happens in some of the beach areas along North Carolina and Virginia. I don't know that there's a solution to that.
That's a huge debate in a lot of these rural localities. They're in a beautiful area. They're, a lot of Southwest Virginia, the initiatives that they're putting forward is they're hitching their hopes on tourism, maybe is something that could make that up. And like you said, those are lower wage jobs. Sometimes they're seasonal. That doesn't always, it's not going to fix everything. And so sometimes you get pushback to that. People say, we don't want tourism jobs here. We want manufacturing. At a certain level, you got to look at it and say, that stuff's probably gone. Tourism might be your best bet. But it might be, I'm a big advocate of not looking at tourism as trying to become Orlando. Like you don't want to become a tourism-driven economy. What you want to do is you want to use tourism to both incentivize the people and also fund the creation of beautiful places that then people will want to be in for other reasons. And I think Charlottesville is a perfect example of that. We have probably a more tourism and recreationally oriented downtown in our downtown mall. But the result of that is we've created this beautiful place, these beautiful wineries all over in Monticello and our downtown mall, and we're not going to live off of the jobs that come with restaurants in the downtown mall, but we do create a very high quality of life that people want to be around. And so then a tech company comes here and says, I can get people to work here for a couple dollars less because they want to live here. And that's all the calculus right now for economic development is can those companies get talent to come, or will people say, I'm not gonna move to whatever.
Luke, you talked about the birth rates and the declining, and you talked about how cities and municipalities need to plan for the growth that's coming. But you also talked about the urban ring of poverty or lower income and lower education. What are some of the solutions for that ring? At one point in the cities, we talked about tax zones to try to give them incentives for building and moving into the cities. What would you do with the urban ring?
I think it's a lot of the same thing that you had to answer about downtowns and central cities years ago. You got to look at those areas, first of all, realistically, and this is sort of a brutal way to say it, but are those areas worth saving or not? A lot of people need, and our consultant right now with our comp plans, pushing people to look at our downtown and say, do you care enough about this to put money into it? Because it doesn't look like you do. And so we need to look at those areas and say some of those areas may not have been built very well. Maybe we need to let them go and be redeveloped. Others, maybe they are worth saving and worth putting through a second golden age there. And so we need to put money into revitalizing them. As far as the people themselves, though, I think one thing I would say is, and I mentioned it briefly, that don't think of the inner ring suburbs as the new ghettos. It's a different situation that's going on right now. In many cases, The main drivers for that suburbanization of poverty are not all push factors. It's not all, it's partially rents going up in the core. But a lot of it is also our move away from federal housing projects that really concentrated poverty in certain areas and towards Section 8 vouchers that put people on the market and give them the ability to get to those areas. It's also automobile ownership and being accessible to the lowest economic rungs. That was for a long time a big social class divide in the U.S., people who could and could not own an automobile. And original suburbs are built to be inaccessible to people that couldn't own an automobile. And now we're in a situation where really even the lowest rungs of the income ladder in America have access to autos. And so I think a lot of the changes that are causing that suburbanization of poverty is just, this house was built for a wealthy family 50 years ago. Now it's kind of further down the totem pole. That family wants a bigger house 10 miles further out, and now it's less valuable, and so it's being sold to a family that might have been in an apartment in the city, and now there's space for their kids, and they're able to kind of being suburbanized for the same reasons that other family was years before. And so some of it is not all, it's not all a giant American tragedy. In some places it is, in some places it's definitely, and what you really see, like I said, is kind of a decline. So like in Charlotte, and this is true in a lot of cities, there's that inner ring where you're seeing decreasing incomes, decreasing education rates. Some parts of that inner ring are still actually quite wealthy. Charlotte and most cities have what's called a favored quarter, where it's kind of the nice side of town and the bad side of town. And so, like, on the nice side of town in Charlotte, you have a lot of really, really well-to-do neighborhoods in that inner ring. And you see the same declines in per capita income, declining education rates, slight increases in poverty. But you wouldn't know it driving through. It's just, it was really wealthy and now it's kind of wealthy, things like that. So it's really kind of an effect that's hit a lot of those areas. And it's making U.S. cities more European, actually. That's kind of a European pattern that was present. I'm of the opinion that the old donut shape was more of an American anomaly, created by the interstate highway system and desegregation and racism. So I think the new donut pattern that we're creating is much more in line with what you see in a lot of global cities.
One quick last question, way in the back.
I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on what could be done or is being done with the inner ring declining shopping centers.
Yes.
Such as Albemarle Square.
That's a super popular topic at planning conferences and stuff like that. Yeah. Some of them being redeveloped as mixed-use centers with a lot of housing, because it's very hard to develop more housing in areas that need more housing when you have vested neighborhoods there opposing it. And so a lot of people look to those areas as possible kind of urban areas. Some counties, like I said, that have pressure to densify, like Virginia Beach, are taking their old strip centers and turning those into more urban areas. Other places, sometimes the strip centers just need to come down. That's a tough thing about the development world and your incentives of development. I describe developers a lot as like boys in a frat house. It's like you have a bunch of dishes, and it's always easier to take a clean dish, use it, put it in the sink, and keep taking the clean dish. And there's no incentive really for you to clean the dish until all the cupboard's empty, and then you grudgingly go back and wash one. So that's kind of the way it is a little bit with development. It's like it's cheapest to develop on a green field, so you build on your shopping center in your green field, and then that thing's worn out, just leave it, go build another thing on a green field, and then finally when all the green field's kind of used up and you just have kind of crappy stuff left, then finally you have to go and do the work to remediate the site and break it up and redevelop it. So that's another reason for that inner ring, outer ring thing, is on the outer ring it's green field development, so that's very profitable, and then in the center of the city the demand's so high and booming that it's worth it to redevelop. And then in the inner ring it's like it's the dishes left in the sink still. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yes. This has been fantastic. Really do appreciate.